Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we're talking about journalism's role in the legalization of cannabis, and we are joined by the esteemed Ricardo Baca, CEO and founder of the Grasslands Agency. Ricardo, thank you for being here with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Eric.
And before we dive into this topic, which is a really fascinating issue to cover, give us an update, if you would, on Grasslands, how you've been hanging in the last couple of months, and just how you're feeling on this fine Wednesday.
You know, feeling like I had one of the most productive days in recent memory, had done a lot of great work for the agency, for our clients, and, you know, the last 3 months have been rough. They've been really, really, really hard. And I know that we're hardly alone in that. So, you know, the long and the short is we lost about 50-55% of our clients in the span of about 2 to 3 weeks back in March. And I'm thankful to say that that has definitely turned around, although we're not quite fully recovered. And but I'm more confident now than I have been in the last 3 months in that. You know, what we do for clients, what the service we provide is immensely valuable, especially at a time like this, when we're stuck at home, when we're spending more time on screens, we're reading more news, you know, spending more time on our social media profiles. This is where we thrive. And I think our clients, past, present, and future, are finally starting to recognize that. And that's been really exciting. So,
Ricardo, what are the signals or the signs that, generally speaking, clients have demonstrated to you that have caused them to sort of come back to the table to conduct business as usual? What are some of those road markers out there?
You know, there's certainly some PPP coming into the mix. You know, we work with cannabis and hemp businesses, but we also work with other businesses and brands and highly regulated industries. And so some of them got PPP and, you know, they came back a knocking, which is great. Private investment, Bob, seems to be waking up as well. I'm sure you're seeing that on your end as well. We've had some clients who have actually closed raises in the last, you know, few weeks here in early June. And I think we can all recognize the kind of seismic shift that represents. So I think that's big as well. And of course, you know, locality, various things happening on the state levels. And so, for example, one of the clients we lost was back in March is a recreational dispensary group in Massachusetts. And of course, Governor Baker out there in Mass misguidedly shuttered those shops. And so it more than made sense when we lost that client, even though we're working on getting them back. But another one of the clients that has since come our way is also a Massachusetts business. And they're not a retailer. They're not in the dispensary game, but they work with dispensaries. And I think just having those channels, those avenues open back up, whether it's happening on the local level or via the financial pathways, you know, that is really the signals, the primary signals that we're seeing in terms of this market reawakening.
The reawakening shouldn't come as a surprise, particularly in light of the fact that the industry effectively grew up, and nobody knows that as well as you, covering it from the very beginning and then some, that this industry from a regulated commercial perspective grew up during a recession. And it was tight money times that caused people to look at other economic opportunities. So it shouldn't be a surprise that we're seeing the focus for investment come back around to cannabis. But can you comment on the you mentioned what the Massachusetts governor did, but can you talk about just the essential designation and the significance of that? We know what that means, perhaps legally. We know what that means. But what does that mean to the world at large? How do you go from a gateway drug to an essential business in just a few short years?
Well, Bob, it's like that Chicago Sun-Times headline from March. And it straight up said, you know, from legal to essential in less than 3 months, which does encapsulate that Illinois story. But, you know, and nobody knows this better than you, Bob, since you're a true OG, but, you know, this essential designation, the impact of it will not fully be felt for years, if not decades to come. I think this is legitimately some of the biggest news this industry has encountered since recreational legalization first happened back in January of 14. You know, this is a monumental moment for this industry and for this movement. And I truly believe that when we are looking back at the timeline of legalization, you know, let's say it's the year 2050, we're looking back, oh, remember those quaint days when we had just such a backward drug policy system, and then we legalized recreational cannabis. I think March of 2020 will legitimately stick out on that timeline as a monumental moment where government and regulators stood up and said, wait a minute, this is essential, and this is why it's essential, whether it is a necessary retail outlet for someone's medicine or whether these dispensaries are actually classified like pharmacies. No matter what, we need to make sure that this essential designation sticks, and we need to make sure that it extends beyond medical dispensaries only to include adult use shops. But, you know, I truly think that this is a huge domino, and I wouldn't be surprised if this essential designation also leads to relaxed regulations in the very near future, because this has completely changed the way that government regulators are talking about cannabis, which has been so necessary because, of course, this is a movement by the people, and it's taken government a while to come around to this conversation.
Well, I love all of the historical significances that you're talking about. And here at the Hoban Law Group and on the Hoban Minute podcast, we talk a lot about the legal history of how we got here and where we're going, of course. But the topic of this conversation being the role of journalism, this is something that you not only know in and out, Ricardo, but you were responsible for and have been celebrated for that. So take us through, you know, back 10 years ago, at the turn of all of this, what you were seeing when you were working at the Denver Post, how journalism helped normalize cannabis and our perception around all of this. Just give us a slice of that, if you would.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, before I started our strategic PR agency, Grasslands, I definitely was a reporter, a journalist for the Denver Post for more than a dozen years, and I worked for daily newspapers for 20 years. And in that time, I definitely saw a lot of journalism being produced that did what journalists do, and that is you quote authoritative sources. You go directly to sources to get data and perspective, and you go to both sides and you share that perspective and that story in the most unbiased way possible. And in the process of watching all of this journalism about cannabis pre-recreational legalization, you saw a lot of government sources being used over and over again. And what that meant was that we were only getting just a very thin sliver of the actual picture. And advocates, activists, they knew the story long before Coloradans and Washingtonians voted to legalize in November of 2012. But the sad thing is, myself and other colleagues who were journalists at the time did not, because the story was being hidden in plain view because it was such a successful propaganda campaign on the part of federal and state and city and county government. And so I guess one of the things that my colleagues and I did do back in November of 2013, the Denver Post appointed me as the newspaper's first ever marijuana editor. And at that time, it was seen as a noticeable shift in how media was covering this, because the editor-in-chief at the time, Greg Moore, he came to the Denver Post from the Boston Globe. He told me straight up, I want you doing serious reporting, and I want you to have some fun with this too, because it's weed. And so we did exactly that. Lots of breaking news. You know, I had access to the entire Denver Post staff, which was such a gift. And it is honestly the only reason the cannabis became what it did, because the Denver Post has these incredible journalists on staff. So I didn't need to be at city council. We had someone there already. I didn't need to be in the state ledge. We had two full-time reporters there already. And by my colleagues and I ultimately covering this space, we helped normalize this industry and this plant to really a stupefying level when you think about it. And I was completely blind to it at the time, but I'll always remember in 2014, 15, I guess it was 15 or 16, the DC think tank, Brookings Institution, came out with a list of like the dozen most important people in cannabis policy that you need to follow right now or something. And there's my face alongside, you know, Hillary Clinton, who was running for president, and Vivek Murthy, who is the, the Surgeon General. And, you know, all of these other people, including like Rand Paul. And at first I thought that was kind of a joke. I thought it was kind of short-sighted, and it really took me leaving journalism and entering communications to recognize the value of what we ultimately provided in that conversation, because you had journalists covering this beat every day, covering this industry as if any other industry like oil and gas or transportation. And by our very nature of doing that, we normalized this tremendously. And while that was not our intention, because our intention was just to service our readers, you know, that was definitely a byproduct of what we did. And it's something that I can be proud of now that I'm no longer a full-time journalist.
Well, it's definitely something to be proud of. You know, Ricardo, it brings me back some of the early days of coverage. I recall this was the early days of edible regulation, right? There was a series, yeah, perhaps, of, you know, I purchased these edibles and it turned out that they had, you know, upon testing 0 grams of or milligrams of THC in them. And then others had, you know, 4 times what was billed on the label. I mean, it was bringing light to what was a nascent industry. But, you know, as a journalist, you covered those things in an objective way, not trying to vilify those companies that did things that they shouldn't have done, but rather to shed light on the fact that this is a new industry and that something has to give here if people are going to sell these products into a mass market that's publicly and commercially available. And some of those brands, unfortunately, are no longer around, perhaps because of their business practices, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, it was attacking this from a policy perspective. It still is. It's attacking it from a product review perspective, or at least a product quality perspective. And those same issues resonate today. But then when you zoom out a little bit, just put your journalist hat on for a minute. And I don't want to get into world turmoil and politics, but what happened to journalism, Ricardo? Journalism used to be, as you articulated, an objective account, painting a picture of both sides. And now people view journalism, or quote-unquote journalism, the quote-unquote news, which is 99% commentary. That's not journalism necessarily, but maybe you can give us a little perspective from the other side of the fence.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, journalism has changed immensely in the last decade plus. And, you know, the very brief lesson on that is, you know, the advent of the internet and websites like Craigslist. Just imagine how quickly that decimated classified advertising revenue. And if you know anything about the bottom line of a newspaper, classified advertising, they were gouging those advertisers. You know, the newspapers I used to work for and every other one, because that was your community bulletin board. When you're hiring or you're selling a car, that's where you go. And suddenly Craigslist is there and it's free and it's easy and it's comprehensive. And of course you're not placing those ads. And that really killed the bottom line and the revenue for a lot of newspapers. And you know, when you're looking at the media landscape, newspapers are really the last bastion of legitimate journalism, because you're not seeing that as much on the cable news side, on the broadcast local news side, and of course, online digital is still very much a free-for-all. And so I think that the advent of the internet and Craigslist, it just took down budgets. And then we're seeing shrinking staff. And then we're seeing increasing competition with digital news sites that were way more digitally savvy than all of these newspapers. Because you think about it, the Arianna Huffington and what she did with HuffPo was so brilliant because in many ways, they weren't producing original journalism. They were aggregating original journalism that was being produced at local levels. And then they themselves were making the ad revenue off that because they were just aggregating it and putting it into an easy to digest form. And so I think that was huge. This rise of the blog, of digital outlets. I mean, think about how many outlets we read these days that don't even have a print element, which is fine. You don't need print for legitimacy, but print is an interesting barrier to entry because if you're going to pay that extra money to have your product printed and then distributed, that is usually a good barrier to entry to say, we plan on doing this seriously, whereas anybody can start a blog, as we've seen, and even micro-publishing without a doubt covers social media, and everybody can create social media with an internet connection and an email address. So I think journalism is sometimes rightfully under attack, but at the same time, I think there is still quality journalism being produced, and of course, powers that be, various people are trying to talk us into thinking otherwise, but I'm still a subscriber to the Denver Post, Washington Post, New York Times, and very much stand behind them as a proud reader and somebody who's been published in all of those outlets as well.
Well, we really appreciate getting your perspective on that, Ricardo, because as Bob said, it's interesting to kind of hear you talk about it as someone who's actually seen a lot of these things that you just wouldn't really think about being a consumer, I guess, of news. I want to come back to something you said at the beginning, which I think is something we saw in the industry at large when this pandemic first really started to hit, which is people divested in their marketing budget. You know, the marketing budget is a quick thing to go when the times get tough. And I'd really love to hear your perspective as you know, the founder of Grasslands and somebody who takes communication so seriously and sees the value in it. That what does this create? Does it create some opportunities? Give us your perspective on that, if you would.
Yeah, sure. You know, I've only been on this PR comms marketing side of the equation for 3.5 years. You know, started Grasslands after I left the Denver Post in December of 2016. So I still consider myself a relative rookie, but in that time, I have noticed that when it comes to marketing and believing in the power of marketing, you have two different kinds of executives. And those who recognize marketing as an essential cost, certainly they stuck with us. We have some clients who stuck with us through this downturn, and we killed it for them in that time, and we're thrilled to still be working with them. And then you also have other executives who don't believe in marketing. And you know, it's just a fundamental way of thinking. But as you said, without a doubt, they oftentimes think that it should be the first thing that is cut anytime your business is thrown into jeopardy. And I get it, you know, but it does remind me of a very fascinating story. And in part because I'm so new to marketing and PR, I'm kind of a reinvigorated, re-inspired student. And so I've been doing a lot of study and learning on this new field that I've chosen. And one really interesting narrative I came across was back in the day, Great Depression. Going into the Depression, there was this brand new, exciting American market known as cold cereal because of course, we ate hot cereal before that. So the industry leader was Post going into the Depression. And then Depression hits, and you know, everybody shuts down their marketing budgets because that's what we're taught to do in business school, unfortunately. And Post shut down its marketing and advertising budget. But meanwhile, the number two brand across town, Kellogg's, they invested in their marketing and they doubled down on their advertising, recognizing that, hey, if my competitor over here is going silent, there is no better time in the world for me to invest and be as loud as possible. And sure enough, Kellogg's came out of the Great Depression as the number one cold cereal brand. And 80 years later, they have not given up that spot. And I think it's such a compelling argument for believing in marketing and recognizing that, you know, this particular economic downturn has made us spend more time in front of our screens, and strong marketing and public relations agencies can get you on those screens. But even outside of that, your competitors are backing down. So of course you should be doubling down right now. So, you know, I very much consider myself a student of this space still, but I love it. And I'm thrilled to see such tangible examples of why businesses and brands should be continuing with those spends now, and also planning on continuing with those spends in the fall and the winter, when we're going to see this second spike that now all these physicians and researchers are talking about.
It's such an unbelievable story, because you you think about it now. We all know Kellogg's. I don't know even the name Post. Just doesn't ring a bell when you say it. Kellogg's does. Sure. The point is incredibly well taken. Before we wrap up, you know, what is your message to the brands that are out there? It does seem that at this time, we are maybe a step or two above, really, in front of having true national cannabis brands, brands that are really recognized across the country as being the go-to cannabis brand. What is the message that you would send to them today, kind of with that story in mind?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree with you more, because I think before we hit 2025, we will have the first big mainstream, national, potentially international, very likely, cannabis brand, as you said, and those brands are sussing it out in the atmosphere right now. You know, sure, a lot of people are paying it safe because they have to. We talked about some of the businesses that had raises that were interrupted, that had business cycles that were interrupted because of regulation and policy. You know, but at the same time, if you can eke out anything to reinvest in your social media marketing program, or, you know, perhaps it's investing in PR for the first time to make sure that you are out there and you are getting your messaging heard by the target audiences that need to hear it most. You know, now is the time that I really think that these brands are going to start stepping out. And I told my staff this the other day. I am confident that some of the brands that are on our roster at Grasslands will be among those brands that are the first big legitimate national brands in mainstream cannabis industry. And you know, it really is putting yourself out there and then making sure that you're consistently following up with a sustained strategy, because of course, without that, without recognizing that PR and marketing are about the long game, then you're spending your money in the wrong place. So I think we are heading toward that era, and it's thrilling, because I'm kind of over all of these state specific brands, you know, even the ones that are selling in 3, 4, 5, 6 states. I think the future is very, very close, and it's also very, very exciting from that perspective of brands.
Well, so there's two things I just wanted to touch on before we run out of time here, and that is the notion of product placement. We did an interview with a fine gentleman named Tony, who's making a movie, and they're making a movie, and it's a cannabis-themed movie, right? And we've seen cannabis-themed movies over the years, certainly, and our friend Kayvon, of course, was attached to at least one of those. But at the end of the day, you've got the idea that while marijuana in particular is still a controlled substance at the federal level and is maligned in so many circles, particularly mainstream circles, there is an opportunity for product placement. Can you comment on that as it relates to, we've seen product placement in as it relates to music, rap artists. We've seen it as it relates to movies. We've seen it as it relates to television shows. Is that something that's real right now and driven to cannabis, or are people still a bit skittish about it?
We are seeing a little bit of it. And Bob, it won't surprise you to know that most of what we're seeing is from non-licensees. And so a lot of the ancillary businesses, one of the ones that sticks out in my mind, because it was relatively early, I'm guessing maybe 2014, PAX had a beautiful product placement and very prominent in an episode of Broad City on Comedy Central. And that was kind of a game changer, you know? It's just like, granted, they make no secret that they are stoners on this show, but then next thing you know, they're busting out this $350 vaporizer. Great placement. We got a call, one of those calls you really, really love to get last year, and it was a producer from the HBO show High Maintenance, and they were looking for brands that could be represented, something that might be pulled out of a bag by the guy. And if you're familiar with the show, the lead character is known as the guy. He's a bicycle delivery cannabis, dealer, and in New York City. And sure enough, what an amazing opportunity for us to put our client's packaging in the mail, so that hopefully it ended up as a prop on this show. So that is straight up product placement, and that season has not yet debuted, so we haven't seen if any of that got taken, but some of our clients definitely have packaging that was mailed to those producers, and I'm really hoping that we see that, because of course that would be classified as earned media, and within that media paradigm we know there's earned, paid, and owned media, and earned is by far the most trusted, and it's even more trusted when some actor playing a character in a show that gives you joy and entertainment and euphoria is actually using the same product that you do. So I think we're getting there, and we'll continue to get there even more as these markets continue to open up and as some of these brands continue to spread their wings.
Well, Ricardo, this conversation will absolutely be to be continued here in the near future, because it has just been an absolute joy and pleasure to get with you and talk about these topics, which we really haven't covered on the Hoban Minute before. This is all very, very important for business owners to be thinking about out there. And we thank you for coming and sharing your perspective with us.
Well, thank you guys. And if I can leave one parting comment, especially given the subject that we've discussed here, it would be to find the media that you really value and benefit from, whether that's a trade publication like Marijuana Business Daily or Cannabis Dispensary Magazine or a mainstream publication, but find that media and support them somehow. And you don't have to subscribe. Even sharing links on your social media platform regularly is supporting media big time. So if I could just leave everyone with that, I would be pleased as punch. I'm really passionate that we need to be media literate, but we also need to support the media that supports us.
Great message, Ricardo. Thank you, as always. Pleasure to talk with you. Look forward to continuing the discussion and hopefully getting together sometime soon.
Without a doubt, Bob, you're a legend. Pleasure being here. And Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ricardo. Take care, Ricardo. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.